When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zubi podcast. On today's episode, we've got on an amazing guest. This is Sohrab Amari. He is the opinion editor at the New York Post and also the author of the brand new book, The Unbroken Thread. So welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
Thank you for having me, Zubi.
No doubt. It's a pleasure to have you here. So I've done a brief intro there, but for people who may not be familiar with who you are and your work, tell them a little bit about you.
Sure. So I was born and raised in Iran. I moved to the United States when I was 13. I've been an ideological or spiritual and intellectual searcher ever since. I've been called a kind of frequent convert, but I decisively converted to Roman Catholicism in 2016, actually while I was living in London, in Britain. And that's obviously my faith has become kind of central dimension to how I approach all sorts of public issues as a commentator here. Now I'm back home in the U.S. now. I was in the U.K. from 2014 to 2018. And I've written a book. It's coming out in Britain from Potter and Stoughton on June 10th. As you said, the title is The Unbroken Thread. The subtitle is Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. And it's a book I wrote basically for my son, Maximilian. He was 2 years old when I started writing. He's now 4 years old. And I think anxieties that a lot of other parents share, and those anxieties have to do with what kind of a man our culture will chisel out of him. A culture that often just tells young people, or anyone, all of us, that to be free means to be, you know, to seek after your own well-being, usually defined in material terms, to get ahead in life and keep your options open, whatever that means, and not to be hindered by traditional restraints and authorities, whether that's religious ones or ancient cultural restraints. These are all seen as a kind of the dead hand of tradition. Mm-hmm. And we are free to the extent that we're not regulated by these things. My worry is that actually that way of life and that way of thinking makes us less free, makes us less happy. And so I wrote this book to try to guide my son and hopefully the reader to an older account of what it means to be free. That's the account we find in Judeo-Christian tradition, but also the Greco-Roman, you know, classical tradition. And also in a lot of Eastern tradition as well, like Confucianism. And so the way I do that is because I'm not a theologian, I'm not a philosopher, I'm just a journalist and storyteller, I pose 12 questions, 12 unasked questions that our society assumes have all been answered or that don't matter anymore because we now have science and technology or something like that. when in fact they're still pertinent questions, and in many ways they poke holes in our contemporary certainties. And I explore each of them through the life of one great thinker. Some of them are kind of predictable. You know, in a book like this, you would definitely have C.S. Lewis, and he's there, and St. Augustine, or Thomas Aquinas. But some of them are kind of will surprise people, like the radical Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, talking about the Sabbath. And so I kind of created a genre where I pose these questions, but then I don't answer them. I use the drama of someone else's life and a great thinker to work my son's way to, I would argue, a better answer than the ones that we typically take for granted.
I hear that. What does the word freedom mean to you? I think that freedom is a really interesting term because, like many terms, like something like equality, it's one of those things that seems to mean very different things to different people. So when you say the word freedom, in your perspective, what does freedom look like?
Well, that's a very good question. Let me just start by debunking the account of freedom that our society provides.
Okay.
The definition of freedom our society provides is to be free means to be able to choose from the widest range of choices. So to choose from among contraries. I can eat burger, I can eat pizza, I can eat chicken, I can wear blue shoes, or I can wear brown shoes, or more radically, I can define my own gender. Mm-hmm. If that's a matter of choice, well, I can define my own sexuality. That's the modern account of freedom. The older account of freedom, which, as I said, I think stretches across many civilizations, and many cultures, but generally the pre-modern version of freedom, is actually that freedom is the freedom to do what you ought to do. That is, they assume that there is an objective account of what makes human beings happy, fulfilled, and for human beings to get to that state, they need to make good choices. Mm-hmm. And those choices are, in each situation, obviously the situations vary among people, but there is sort of one constant elements or set of constant elements that make all people happy across all time, across all culture. And so to be free means to be able to fulfill that version of yourself, to be able to, and in order to do that, because human beings also have all sorts of base appetites and they can be tyrants to themselves, let alone political tyrants like dictators or what have you. There's a tyrant inside you who keeps you away from your true happiness because it seeks after sort of immediate sexual gratification or is greedy or is irresponsible. So to be free in this older version means to be able to conquer that interior tyrant, so that when the ancients say self-government, they don't just mean that we get to vote and choose our political leaders. It also means that you literally govern yourself, and you're detached from these kind of your tendency to be acquisitive, your tendency to be greedy, your tendency to be vicious, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so it's not necessarily the case that just being unrestrained and unrestricted, you're free. In fact, the truly free person in this account of freedom accepts limits, accepts various limits, because they help him toward his or her true fulfillment.
Mm. I hear that. My immediate thought to it, however, would be, is by that definition, couldn't anybody of any ideology use that and claim authority over it to ram down whatever their personal or ideological view should be? So, for example, I've heard similar arguments sort of used to argue against concepts such as freedom of speech, mm-hmm. right? Or, for example, in the USA, against the Second Amendment, some people would actually make an argument that it gives people less freedom because it's potentially dangerous, or it could potentially harm people or put people at risk. And if people are not safe and secure, then they're not free. I've actually heard people justify the measures that have happened over the past year and a half using sort of a similar logic that unless everyone adopts this authoritative view of safety then actually people are not free. So I, whilst I understand what you're saying, and if the world were run by angels, then I'm more on board with it. But given that sort of anyone in an authoritative position could say, okay, well, I know what's best for everybody else, and so this is my view on it, and this is how it should be. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, so first of all, I would say that we would have to come to an agreement of whether or not there is an objective morality. That is, yes. That there are, that good things are good and bad things are bad. And that human beings, using their natural reason, set aside religion or divine revelation, just your natural reason, you can discern what's good for an individual and discern what's good for a political community. If that's the case, then the authority that, whatever that may be, now in some places it might be a king, it might be a democratically elected government, any authority that leads people toward what truly makes people happy, towards their good, the common good of the whole, and common good is not, doesn't destroy the individual good, it's actually, it builds on and helps the individual, it expands the individual good as well. So any authority that does that is not not necessarily an authoritarian or a dictator or an oppressor, a better word for it, is not a tyrant. There are tyrants when either an individual or a government unjustly imposes on a people various measures that go against what objectively is good for people, which, again, we have to be able to decide whether we can even know that. But if you assume with me that good things are good and bad things are bad, and you can know that, then there is not this tension between authority and the individual conscience, right? So let me put this in a concrete example. In the modern sense, in the past 200-300 years, what it means to have a free conscience got redefined to mean whatever you interiorly think. So its conscience became completely privatized. We could go trace the history of this. It partly has to do with the Reformation and the concept of private judgment, beginning with I get to interpret the Bible on my own without some hierarchical authority telling me. And that got dilated over time to mean my own conscience also with respect to the moral dilemmas of my life. I have kind of sovereign right to decide it. But if a conscience doesn't reflect some objective moral law, then it has no value, has no strength. In other words, in a situation where you say, well, one conscience may come to believe that it's okay to abort unborn children, and another conscience might come to believe that it's not okay to abort unborn children. And neither, no one can be sure which of the two is right. Then the conscience loses its value because it's a kind of completely private, relativistic thing. A conscience is only a conscience insofar as it reflects some, again, that deeper account of what it means to be truly human, truly moral, so forth. And an authority is only an authority if, a legitimate authority, if it vindicates that moral law. So in other words, an unjust authority that goes against the natural law, goes against the moral law, is not an authority. That's just a vicious tyrant. But an authority that helps guide people and form them toward the true good, and therefore, in a way, amplifies the voice of the individual conscience, that's not a tyrant. That's a legitimate authority. Now, every government on earth, one way or another, when it makes laws, uses coercion. There's no situation in which some amount of coercion is impossible. So the question is, who coerces, toward what ends, and whether it does so reasonably or viciously and so on and so forth. But there's no situation you could ever find in which, in a way, you're not morally regulated. And we see now with the loss of kind of traditional authorities, like the kind of the church, the traditional family, and so on and so forth, it's not that we've become totally liberated. Instead, we've had these kind of substitute authorities that are much more unreasonable, like gender ideology, where you're kind of forced to
acknowledge things that you know aren't true, right? About the sort of embodied biological basis of sex. And if you don't use the right pronouns, you can get in trouble in the public square. So we are coerced no matter what. The question is whether that coercion upholds a good, reasonable account of what it means to be human, what it means to be happy, or one that's unreasonable, like the one that kind of is being shoved down all of our throats the past, especially the past two, three years. It's kind of so intense.
Who determines that? Who sets those rules?
So, I mean, classically, I mean, someone like Aristotle, who's sort of the basis of so much of Western political thought, and then as Aristotelian thought gets incorporated into the moral teaching of the Catholic Church, which is sort of the basis for a lot of concepts when people say natural law, through St. Thomas Aquinas, would say either the people as a whole do it, or some person who's designated as a kind of political regent or actor. So that might be, in some societies, it might be a ruling party, and that's democratically elected. In some cases, it might be a monarchy, a constitutional monarchy, or whatever you might have. But that's the responsibility of the ruler to lead his people to happiness. That's ethics 101, sort of chapter one of the ethics.
Mm-hmm. Has anyone actually successfully done that, though? Much of that.
Is perfection achievable on Earth? Mm-hmm. No, I mean, and you yourself said there's fallen people, but are there better and worse situations?
Yeah. Totally. Agreed. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an interesting concept. It's one of those things where, it's a weird one. In theory, I partly agree. I just also think that everybody, including, you know, perhaps my own or your own, say, ideological opponents, also think the same thing. But what they're calling good, you may call bad or evil, and what we may call good, they may call bad or evil. So I'm not trying to be super morally relativistic.
No, I know, but
kind of think of, okay.
Just because there are many opinions about the good doesn't mean that there isn't an objective good. So,
No, I don't disagree on that. I just think, I don't know. I mean, there would have been a time in history for many, many times where people would have argued that, I don't know, a super long running institution such as slavery is an objective good. And the vast majority of people are in agreement, and the governments are in agreement, and the so-called leaders, even some of the religious leaders, etc., are all in agreement. And in fact, in some cases, are even using religious books to attempt to justify it. So being now in 2021 and being modern day humans, we all look back at that, regardless of political ideology, and everyone is like, oh my gosh, like that's appalling. That's obviously objectively immoral, enslaving a human being or mistreating people like that, etc.
Right. But notice, as you do that, you make a definitive moral judgment. So you suggest that there is a...
I'm not in the everything is relative camp at all. I think when it comes to morality, it's an interesting question. I think it's a little bit of a sliding scale. I think there are certain things where it's like very, let me say, objectively bad and wrong. Like there are some things that's just, okay, murder. We all agree, conservative, liberal, libertarian, whatever, you know, religious, irreligious, whatever, everyone agrees, murder, wrong. Maybe they reach that by different pathways or explain it in slightly different ways why they think it's wrong. And there are certain things like that. And then I think there are some other things where it's more gray, or at least it appears to be more gray. It certainly appears to be, and you know, you might have a 50-50 split in the population where this side is saying, no, this is the objective morality. This other side is saying, no, this is the objective morality. And is it just a democracy thing wherever who has the most voices, or where is the ultimate authority on that? And when it comes to authority as well, people believe in different authorities. One question I actually had for you, which is interesting, is, you, am I right in saying you converted to Catholicism about 5 or 6 years ago? Is that
2016? So yeah,
2016. Okay. So on a subject like this, what prior to that were you simply atheistic or agnostic?
Yeah, I mean, I declared myself an atheist when I was 13.
Okay.
A long time for me to, through a process of reading, actually reading the Bible and reading books by Pope Benedict.
Okay.
A great intellectual. I became convinced that not only is there a God, but a personal God, and ultimately a God who's revealed himself in the Hebrew Bible and ultimately is the incarnate God of the cross. I wrote a memoir about that. I titled From Fire by Water. It's kind of long, circuitous journey.
Okay.
But, you know, one of the criticisms that I often get for this new book is, you know, you stand for, let's say, traditionalism, that society should help authoritatively guide people. So, for example, in the new book, I argue that we should restore Sunday trading bans, blue laws, they call them.
Okay.
So, actually, in Britain, they're still, I believe they're not entirely been done away with. But in the United States.
In the UK, stuff opens late and closes early. In some European countries, totally closed on Sunday.
Like Germany, for example. Germany, France, Vienna, Austria. But in the United States, in the beginning in the 20th century, slowly these blue laws were chipped away at. The last statewide blue law was actually only overturned in 2019. And I think that examining this kind of helps make my case and illuminate what kind of traditions I'm talking about. The people who said we should do away with the blue laws argued that, you should have choice. On Sunday, some people want to work, some people want to shop, some people want to worship, and so you should be able to do that. So it looks like they promised a kind of liberation. What it means in practice, given the way our economy works, is that this liberty turned out to be really liberty for large corporations and retail, kind of big box retail stores who wanted to be open on Sunday, because the smaller businesses, the mom and pop shops, couldn't staff the extra hours anyway. So they weren't the ones who were clamoring for this. It's like the Chamber of Commerce, large corporation. And set aside the religious dimension of blue laws or Sunday trading bans, it's good for people to spend one day a week kind of just with family, contemplation. It just was bad for workers, right? In the sense that one more of the day of the week became consumed with this kind of harried lifestyle where you don't have any pause. And especially bad for working class people whose schedules are often very itinerant. It's not like white collar people, professionals, still actually manage to get some time with their families sometimes on Sundays and so forth. When you're at the mercy of Amazon warehouse managers in terms of when you work, you sort of, they might schedule you just when you have a soccer game or a football game for your kid, and you lost that opportunity. And we're all just ever more harried, right? The loss of the Sabbath, the idea of rest, has not kind of left us liberated. We're just always miserable. If you're a white collar type like me, your phone is all buzzing. So what I'm trying to suggest is that what was looked like a restriction in traditional society, right? Why did the Sabbath so important to ancient peoples? Whether it's Jews, Christians, or Muslims, they designated different days to be the one day that's holy or separate from the rest of the week. But they all had the same idea that somehow these restrictions actually make us freer. What looked like liberation, the loss of that, in practice turned out to be a loss of freedom, a loss of peace, a loss of kind of having a little bit of repose and time with your family. Now, what people, to get back to my original point, what people will say to me is, you were able to reach your Catholic faith only through this process of kind of discovery and choice making that liberal societies like ours be possible. I don't think that's actually true. I think people converted in pre-liberal, pre-modern times as well. But the larger point is that, yes, I mean, I value the journey that I went through, and I wrote a book about it. That I went through this gauntlet of terror before I reached truth. But I don't necessarily want society to be organized in such a way where everyone, we set up a society where a life of decent, ordinary virtue is very difficult. Children are assailed by pornography before they hit puberty, right? 9 out of 10 teenagers hit see hardcore porn before they 10, 11. That's a bizarre society. Mm-hmm. and in all sorts of other ways, you just sort of face degradation and then see, okay, well, who can make it through that gauntlet of temptations and errors to reach truth? Mm-hmm. Society should kind of make it easier for people to make the journey that I did, is what I'm suggesting.
Mm, I understand that. How so? When you say society should do that, do you mean individuals or communities or state governments, federal governments? What sort of level are we talking here, and what could be done?
Well, there's a principle in Catholic, it's a Christian social teaching called subsidiarity, which means that every problem should be left to the smallest being possible to solve it. That is, if you, for example, have a problem that only is a matter for a town mayor, let's say, in a small town in southern England, let's say, and the sort of local council can solve it, that it's inappropriate for the national government, like Westminster Parliament, to rule on that, right? Because then it's a kind of imposition on it. Even smaller, if something can be solved by private families, by families on their own, then the local council shouldn't impinge on that. But there are problems that, you know, are national problems, and that those call for national or international solutions. So I'm open to where that falls. I mean, in some cases, things can be done. What I'm wary of is a certain kind of libertarian here in the United States says, you have massive opioid addiction. The problem, I would say, of pornographization of daily life, which must be doing something to the fact that people aren't forming families and men aren't dating, and not settling down. Could it be that they, this widespread access to hardcore porn is sort of twisting our brain? And a certain type of libertarian, will say, look, that's why the churches need to preach, and that's why all of us need to quote unquote evangelize the culture or act in civil society. And those private exhortations are good. I don't discount the value of it. Mm-hmm. But, in other cases, you need state action because it's a problem that individuals or families can't solve. Yes. That's why we have government. And again, there has to be an element of, St. Thomas says in the Treatise on Law, that private exhortations in virtue are good, but they're not efficacious because there needs to be penalty and law to help people live virtuously. You know? Mm-hmm. The level of government, again, is depends on the problem. Some problems can be solved at a local level.
Yeah, I understand. I think the reason why I know the concern of a lot of libertarians, including myself, if I'm to call myself one, with some of those notions is simply, there's something I often say, which is like just being wary of bringing weapons to the party that you wouldn't want used against you.
I get right? it. I get
yeah,
it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the concept of, okay, if this is, you know, you've got your people, your side is running things for a period of time. And so in that case, okay, the government doing that is fine because I agree with it. Government doing that's fine because I agree with it, et cetera. But then you get the issue of, oh, okay, that swaps around and maybe there's someone in power who you are very much ideologically at odds with. I mean, what's going on now? You've got this whole woke ideology, people pushing critical race theory, gender ideology, et cetera, and institutionalizing it, putting it into schools, universities, workplaces, et cetera. People are like, hey, no, I don't want this. And they're like, we don't care if you don't want it. Like you're having this, right? This is mandatory. This is coming from the state now. And there could even be penalties, not just socially, but even legally, or even if it's you being deplatformed or kicked off of social media because you said the wrong pronoun or you did the wrong thing. And so my view in light of that is, maybe no one should have that power. So I can understand why people make that argument. I think it's less about the means to get there. I think a lot of it is the, no, well, it's not, it's less about the end goal, and it's more about, okay, this is something that once that power is there and that precedent has been set, this weapon can easily be then used to batter other people over the head, whether that's religious people or it's conservatives or it's people who think this or it's people who think that, etc. So that's, I know for me personally, and I think for a lot of libertarian leaning people, that's always a big concern. And I think even, I don't know, even from, I've got friends who are, you know, more liberal, more left leaning, etc. And even if it's, say, someone who's, was super crazy anti Trump, right? Mm-hmm. Who's someone who legitimately thought he's a racist and he's the next Hitler and he's a white supremacist, whatever. And I'm like, okay, so you do want to give that government more and more power, right? Do you want them to have even more authority over your reach? And of course, when Trump is president, they'll be like, no, we don't want, you know, the Trump administration doing all this stuff. But then it's like, okay, well, maybe that position of power should be limited and kept in check so that they can't just put in boundaries. It's a complicated one. Like, it's one of those issues. I can very much understand the different perspectives. I'm just very much I'd say politically I'm libertarian, but then sort of socially or in my personal life, I'm not, you know, I'm not super libertarian. I'm relatively kind of moderately conservative, I would say.
Go ahead. The point about this one I hear often.
Okay.
You use power, someone else will use power. There's one basic point, which if you go into politics, you're going into politics to use power.
Sure.
The political animals. And so the idea that, I shouldn't use power because someone else might use it. Basically, as a political actor, you're basically saying, I don't want to accomplish it. The other point is, I would suggest that, it's just impossible to not have some orthodoxy enshrined in the public square. We see that now so clearly. In other words, the typical American conservatives, but also I think in Britain, the Tories or kind of conservative kind of cultural actors, went along with the idea that, you know, let's leave it to private communities and private actors and not try to enshrine them. And what you see is when the traditional authorities fall, what comes in their place is not live and let live. Mm-hmm. It's wokeism, it's critical race theory, yeah, it's gender ideology, and it's coercive. So there's no situation in which a kind of vacuum persists. So you had an older, let's say, set of traditional authorities, which wasn't perfect, including not least in the fact that, yes, racism was picked into it in the United States, illegally, so that had to be reformed. I'm not against every reform, obviously. But the loss on the whole of the kind of neo-Christian framework that guided the West has not resulted in the kind of libertarian utopia of living that live. Some other force was always bound to come in. It just so happens that the older kind of Theo-Christian framework had this account of the inherent dignity of the human person. Mm-hmm. And it also had an account of human beings as fallen. Mm-hmm. And that actually restrained government, because if you believe that everyone's fallen, you're willing to give everyone a break. You might uphold an orthodoxy, but in practice you're very, very tall. You can be very, very tolerant. Mm-hmm. And certainly the fall applied equally to everyone. Now we have, for example, in critical race theory, an account of original sin that just applies to certain people. If you're, white, you carry the sin of racial, the stain of racial sin that can't be washed, but for you, bowing down to evil community. you know what I mean?
Yeah, so
I just feel like, Well, bottom line, I just think one orthodoxy or other will always be enshrined in the public square. The only question is, choose. Do you want a reasonable one, or do you want a
Yeah, I agree with what you said in theory, But in practice, I feel like that didn't really happen, or it took so long. So, I mean, we're both Christians here. And so we're talking about a value system going back 2000 plus years. But I mean, if you take a country such as the USA, it took until the 1960s. It took 2000 years for those Christian principles about people, all men being created equal and, you know, equality. It took so long for that to be, to reach that level. So whilst I sort of, in theory, I totally agree with that, but then in practice, I'm like, wow, despite all that, and despite Christianity actually playing a much bigger role and having more authority in society for, you know, millennia, it's only relatively recent that people through various means reached a level of thinking, oh, okay, this should apply to everybody. The rules should be equal and fair, sure, and the laws should be equal and fair, etc. So,
let me note though that two things. One is that historic Christianity, after the sort of the conversion of the Emperor Constantine, when it becomes the official first the legal religion and then the official religion of the Roman Empire, in various ways humanized the Roman Empire, right? Mm-hmm. Various religious orders fought against the idea that if a child is unwanted, you just expose it, leave it outside the city walls. That became non-normative. The status of women was much improved, right? Because that in Christianity, there's sort of the dignity of a woman as equally made in the image of God as man. And then later, obviously, various religious orders into late antiquity and the medieval era campaigned against slavery. Mm-hmm. The American situation was unique in many ways. The kind of pseudo-scientific, racialized ideology that characterized especially slavery and then later the sort of apartheid regime in the United States is a modern thing. It's not inherent or intrinsic is to Christianity at all. It just unfortunately used the rhetoric of Christianity and lent the legitimacy of the cross. You abuse the cross to legitimate these awful racial systems. But I would note that it's interesting that the movement to abolish then slavery and then ultimately the civil rights movement did not come from a place of atheism. Mm-hmm. William Wilberforce, the great British abolitionist, was obviously devout evangelical. Dr. Martin Luther King used the language of natural law and Thomas Aquinas to critique apartheid in the American South. I would say that are there bad traditions? Absolutely. But the way you critique them is by going to the commanding heights of a better, truer tradition. Whereas the loss in the atheist regimes in the 20th century were the worst regimes, right? The communism, Nazism, with this kind of neo-pagan. Because if you don't think there's anything special about the origins of the human person, its origins and destiny, then you can do anything to grow. Death camp.
Mm-hmm. Well, even a simple concept of the idea that, you know, you are the absolute highest authority and that there's no authority over you looking above you. I think that also changes the way people behave. And so I think if you have I think one thing a lot of dictators, most maniacal dictators have in common is they think they position themselves as gods, right? Mm-hmm. They think that they're not accountable for anything. They're above the law. They can't sin because they themselves determine what is a sin and what is not. When a man has that sort of unchecked power or a regime does, then, I agree. That's when you get the most horrendous tyrannies. And we've seen that play out in multiple countries. We've seen that happen in history, etc. I think it's a really interesting one because how would I put it? It's one of those things where I think people can, depending on what someone's belief system and ideology is, it's kind of easy. People tend to cherry pick and gloss over certain things and then cherry pick certain things to kind of back it up. A lot of atheists, for example, will say, oh, you know, well, religion is divisive, or it does this, or, you know, one weird thing people sometimes say is only religion can make a good person do a bad thing or something like that. And I'm just like, no, that's very ahistorical. Like, you know, are there religious extremists and terrorists? Yes, absolutely. Right? I'm not denying that. But to sort of suggest that that's the average or standard religious person is not honest. Just like it wouldn't be honest to suggest that the average person who's atheistic is, you know, some sort of horrible communist or Nazi or something like that. It's sort of I think people can use any ideology, whether it's religious or political or neither, to justify all sorts of stuff. That seems to be the reality of it. You can get extremists and terrorists of anything. You know, there are environmental terrorists, right? There are people who say, oh, I want to conserve the world so much, and I care so much about animals that I want to wipe human beings off the planet. And I'm like, well, you know, that's a strange justification for what you're trying to do there. But yeah, no, it's a really, really interesting conversation. I'm very interested in your, I know you have written a book on it, but I'm interested in your own conversion story and how that has shifted as someone who is an atheist for decades. In this case, how have your views, even with some of the things you're saying right now in this conversation, how have some of those views changed and developed over time? Because I'm assuming the you of 15 years ago would probably disagree with a lot of the things you're saying now.
Yeah. So, yeah, when I was a teen going into my early 20s, I was a kind of hard leftist, like a Marxist.
Okay.
Trotskyist. And my idea was that, you know, in a way, I started with Nietzsche and his kind of declaration that God is dead. And I think I drew the natural conclusion that if God is dead, then man is not a creature subject to any kind of cosmic norms. He can do whatever he wants. He can build society, reorder everything as he pleases, which is an invitation to precisely the kind of radicalism that disfigured the 20th century. And I took that seriously. But then over time, my views changed, and I'll go into a little bit of this. One of them was, you know, after college, I did a program called Teach for America, which dispatches recent college graduates to underserved communities across the country. And in my case, my Teach for America assignment took me to the U.S.-Mexico border, just on the sort of southern tip of Texas. And I always assumed that the question of the achievement gap, the fact that typically in the United States, children from poor families don't do as well with schooling. Those are typically more affluent, lighter peers. It must be a question of redistributive justice. Like, if only these school districts had more federal money, then the problem could be solved. But when I actually went there, I thought, okay, well, money can be a factor, but there's also other kind of issues, like whether the teachers are actually committed to helping these kids teach and setting expectations and not assuming that just because they're poor, they can't learn. So I think that shifted me slightly to the political right. And then, you know, I happened to have a roommate during this time. He was also in Teach for America. He was also a teacher, but he took the job a lot more seriously than I did. I just thought it's like something to put on my resume to like go to something else like law school. Whereas in his case, you know, he would show up to class at 5 a.m, and it's a lesson plan, teach very rigorously through the day, and then afterwards stay after school to like help the kids who hadn't learned and do extra work and so forth. Whereas I was just, like I said, I would like show up at the minimum kind of required time and leave as early as possible. But over time, as I watched him, I noticed that, you know, his professionalism, his sort of fundamental decency was attractive. And it seems to suggest that there is actually an objective standard of right and wrong in conduct. And if there's an objective standard, then I should try to bring myself to measure myself by its yardstick, bring myself into conformity with that objective standard. And that led me to ask, you know, where is it, why was this interior sense seared into me that there is right and wrong? in every situation. What was that voice of the conscience that tells you you should try to do good to avoid evil? Eventually, after a long time of again, reading the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, and then reading Benedict's books, I came to be convinced, as C.S. Lewis was, this was his preferred proof for the existence of God, that the existence of the conscience, points to there being some, supreme, being who's the Lord of that objective moral order. And so that I basically intellectually became convinced that there's a God. It didn't bother me that, okay, so there are people who are biologists who would say that's what you think is your conscience is really just the product of thousands of years of evolutionary change or certain behaviors helped our species and they were ingrained in our minds as preferred behaviors. That could all be true as a matter of the how questions, but they didn't answer the why questions. And in order to answer the why questions, you have to go to metaphysics. That's how I became. And I was living in London and I was especially drawn to Catholicism for various reasons. I'd gone to the masses times. Moments of my life where I was in crisis. I don't know why I was an atheist, but I go to Catholic masses. And then eventually I went to this one mass at the Brompton Oratory, which is known for really beautiful kind of traditional liturgy. I was so awed by this that I said, okay, I've been called to be a Catholic. And I went to the oratory house, which is where the priest lives, like the rectory, and knocked on the door, and this wise and old English priest answered the door, and he had this sort of most posh English accent I've ever heard. And it's like, yes. And I said, I want to become a Catholic father, and he didn't miss a beat. He just said, very well, I shall instruct you.
That's good. That's good. I'm glad the UK is repping in that sense.
Yeah.
What do you think is the future of religion in the Western world? Where do you honestly think things are going? Because I see a lot of different potential paths. Some things are suggesting to me that there could be some sort of resurgence and revival of Christianity. In some sense, I am seeing a lot of people who are either current, even a lot of vocal, fairly public atheists or agnostics, if not coming to God directly, actually at least appreciating the role of religion more. I think as some of these secular religions and ideologies have come into the picture, they've started to sort of appreciate those roots a little bit more, even if they do not literally understand all of the things or believe in God so much themselves. They at least are more empathetic towards it and can see some of the positives that have come from it. On the other hand, there's also data suggesting that, as each year passes in the UK and the USA, there are less people going to church or less people describing themselves as being religious, etc. And then also less so in the US, but also in the UK and in Europe, there is a growing Islamic population. There's a growing number of Muslims. They are, in terms of pure demographics, they tend to be having more children, etc. And you're starting to see more of a pushback in certain areas, certainly in the UK, coming from the Muslim community. A great example is the whole LGBT teaching in schools and stuff. I'm sure you've seen there have been certain communities, especially in Birmingham, up in the Midlands, where Muslim parents are the ones saying, no, like, I do not want my children learning this stuff. This should not be in a school. And it seems like when I saw recently there was a Christian, was he a chaplain or like a school priest or something like that, who recently was essentially forced to resign or pushed out because
I think Scotland somewhere
that's a different one. A different one. There's just a chaplain in one of the schools here, a so-called Christian school, where he, they were bringing in organizations and paying for, these various LGBT organizations to come and, push gender ideology in the schools, etc. And he was like, no, very mild-mannered guy. I watched some interviews with him. You know, he's not even someone who's forceful. He's just like, no, I think this is a bad idea. I don't think the kids should be learning this at, you know, 8 years old or whatever it is. And again, this is supposed to be a Christian school. And instead of them responding in a way I thought would, you know, be much better and bolder, they instead decide to fire him to not receive any heat. So I don't know, with all of those things, we're in this position where I'm kind of like, well, what's going on here? And then I think we're also very much in the age of the rise of, you know, secular religions / cults, which are playing a lot of the role of religion for certain people, but without the salvation aspects, yeah, and without
the good stuff.
yeah, without the positives.
Just the penance and the discipline.
Yes,
and not the love.
You're
right about all those trends. I don't know. I'm not a good prognosticator. I have theological hope, so mm-hmm. God's in control, and it'll all be fine in the very long term. In the short term, I don't know. I see it, as you said, the same trends of deep secularization. Mm-hmm. Well, secularization is the wrong word, because as you said, these substitute religions in a way, yes, are popping up. There's a kind of religious fervor behind the COVID restriction.
Oh boy. Very much so.
It even has the modesty arms, right?
Yes. As someone who also grew up in the Middle East, it's hilarious to me that people
here I've noticed because I live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It's just, yeah, this very chichi, older and whiter neighborhood. And the women put up their masks when you walk by, the way, you know, Mahajaba is locked. They see you, they're sort of like,
ah. Yeah.
Although it's kind of ending now. But yeah. Now, in all seriousness, though, I think there's de-Christianizations. I shouldn't say secularization, because other substitute isn't one, but there's de-Christianization in the United States, especially among elites, and then in Europe, it's so widespread, and Germany, mass attendance rates are so dismal. I don't know, but I will speak from a Catholic perspective that the future of the Catholic Church is very much in Africa, in South Asia, in East Asia, less so in South America. In South America, obviously, there's evangelicals and Pentecostals and a lot of inroads.
Okay.
But among Catholics, it's the global South is where the future of the church is, as far as I can tell. And that's fine. I mean, there's nothing that said that, like, just because Europe has like a whole bunch of old cathedrals, that's going to always be the center. There'll be new cathedrals put up in Dhaka and Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's anything that, how do I put this? What are there some mistakes that you think the church is making when it comes to maintaining congregations and maintaining interests? And with that said, what do you think can be done? I'm certainly not a fan of this sort of, like, you know, so-called progressive Christianity, which is just sort of woke them with a cross,
yeah,
and which doesn't seem to have much to do with actual Christianity. I've seen some pretty worrying stuff in that regard. But sometimes I wonder what can be done, if anything. You know, maybe nothing is to be done, but what can be done to bring that back? I mean, even when you go to a lot of churches in the UK, it might be the same in the US, it's primarily an older demographic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there will be some young people, but there's sort of the demographics are not looking
good.
Positive. No, they're not looking good, right? It's looking like, okay, in a few decades, these people will be gone, and who's coming to replace them?
We'll see. I mean, sometimes I think it feels like the West is sort of slipping into a dystopia, honestly.
Yes.
And that the negative quality will actually be a source of religious awakening, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, people will be like, oh, okay, well, this isn't working. Let's see what other answers have been proposed through the ages. I do agree. I mean, one of the things that bothers me as a Catholic is the fact that so many churchmen, Catholic institutions here in the United States, like Catholic universities, are adopting the language of critical race theory as a response to racism, where it's like, no, you have this whole tradition. We have Genesis that says man is made in God's image. You don't need, like, this pernicious ideology. You have a better answer to racism, and it's the Major Dei. Mm-hmm. Not Kindi. I don't know why I keep bringing him up, but not
him and Robin DiAngelo have a
DiAngelo.
Lot too.
Yeah, exactly.
Those two are responsible for a lot of stuff.
I know, they really have to. But you know, it's a good grip if you can get in on it. You know?
Yeah. they've taken race grifting and hustling to a whole
new level. What I loved about Robin DiAngelo is, I don't know, it recently came out that she's speaking at University of Minnesota or something, and her speaking fee just absolutely dwarfed her fellow African American speaker. So, like, the black speaker was getting paid like $7,500. Robin DiAngelo was making, you know, $20,000 for Is that equity?
Yeah, it's mind blowing to me. It really blows my mind that I don't know. We're in a weird place. There's so many things I'm very optimistic about, and I'm naturally an optimist. And then there are some things that I'm just like, okay, this is a really disturbing trend here. You know, with the whole critical race theory stuff and some of this ideology, I'm just like, man, there's a good chance the next generation is going to end up being more racist than, say, my generation. Oh, hello.
This is my daughter, Fina. She was banging her.
Oh, hello.
Say hi.
Joining in on the podcast.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one thing that does concern me is that, if the critical race theorists are not challenged and are allowed to continue on the path they're on, then they're going to create a whole generation of people who are just, you know, it's just going to go backwards. It's going to go backwards towards people just seeing themselves as, you know, white people are this and black people are that, and just literally creating problems that were solved many decades ago.
Right. Yeah. Objectivity is a white value. That's the most racist thing I've ever heard.
Logic.
Logic is a white value.
Mathematics, staying on, being on time.
Ugh.
I'm just like, I saw that. I was just like, good grief. How? It's comical in a sense. Like, it does make me laugh. Just like some of the, you know, I'm sure you saw my deadlift where I identified as a woman and, you know, broke a British record and became famous off of that, which is hilarious. But at the same time, I'm just like, how is this a debate? Like, why are we still having this conversation about men, biological men competing in women's sports? Like, this should not be a conversation. It never was before.
Yep.
And you've just now created this problem out of thin air. And now here we are, and, you know, people are being called all sorts of horrible names for saying that it's dumb. It's strange. And then those same people will claim to be pro-science.
Yes. That's the hill I will die on. That would be a text. I will die on that hill because I will not say something that's just not true. I won't say 2 + 2 = 4. Yeah, I mean, equals 5. Sorry. Whatever Winston is forced to say.
Yeah. No doubt. So, your book is, it's out now, or it's about to come out?
In Britain, it comes out in June 10 from Hodder and Stoughton.
Okay.
It's posted Hodder.
So by the time this podcast comes out, the book will be out. So, and where will people be able to check it out? Amazon and the usual channels?
Amazon.co.uk, you know, the, foils. All the British bookstores.
Awesome. And where can people find and follow you online?
I'm at Sohrab Amari, at S-O-H-R-A-B like Bravo, last name Amari, A-H-M like Mary, A-R-I.
Awesome.
And also visit nypost.com. That's our opinion page.
Awesome. Sohrab Amari, man, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. It's been really, really interesting to talk to you.
It's been fun. It's been great. Thanks, Eddie. I am the man.
sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the grand. Stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.